The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Julia Golding, a multi-award winning writer for adults and young adults. Her first book, The Diamond of Drury Lane, won the Waterstones Children's Book Prize and the Nestle Children's Book Prize. A former British diplomat and Oxfam policy advisor, she's now published over 50 books in genres ranging from historical adventure to fantasy. Her new children's book, The Curious Crime, is out now, as well as the latest instalments in her Curious Science series, Rocky Road to Galileo and Hunt with Newton. Also with us is Debbie Howells, a Sunday Times top 10 best-selling author. Her new book, The Death of Her, is her third novel and is a haunting psychological thriller. It follows The Beauty of the End and Richard and Judy book club title, The Bones of You. We also have C.M. Taylor, who teaches at the Oxford International Centre for Publishing Studies and is also a freelance editor of fiction. His books include Premiership Psycho, which has been optioned for TV. His latest novel, Staying On, is a comic and touching geriatric coming-of-age story about the impact of Brexit on British expats in Spain. And finally, on tonight's book show is Grace Mead, one of America's leading trial attorneys turned authors and its first transgendered trial attorney. She disclosed that she was transgendered 4 years ago when she started presenting authentically full time. Defense of Another is a work 11 years in the making and her debut novel. It draws from her own personal experience and is an emotionally charged exploration of what it means to be gay in modern America. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Julia Golding. She's a multi-award winning writer for adults and young adults. Her first book, The Diamond of Drury Lane, won the Waterstones Children's Book Prize and the Nestle Children's Book Prize. A former British diplomat and Oxfam policy advisor, she's now published over 50 books in genres ranging from historical adventure to fantasy. Her latest book is called The Curious Crime, with themes of diversity, tolerance and interaction between science and faith. She also has a couple of new books in her Curious Science series, Rocky Road to Galileo and Hunt with Newton. Welcome to the book show, Julia.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So let's look at your new book then, The Curious Crime. Is this the start of a new series?
Well, I don't know about that. I didn't kill everybody off at the end, just that's a bit of a plot spoiler. I did think of it as a standalone. I left the door open, but we'll just have to see what walks through at the end.
Does it make a difference that the feedback you get from readers?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So you usually get a sense from a book if people feel it needs more. So, for example, you mentioned The Diamond of Drury Lane, which... In the end, it started as a book on its own, but then became a six-book series. So I'm being purposely open. I just wait to see what happens. If it takes and people like it and they say, hey, what happens to the characters next, then I'll think about that. I actually have put a little trail in the book for the eagle-eyed reader as to where I think it might go.
Brilliant. So The Diamond of Drury Lane that we mentioned, is it possible? I know it's a difficult question to answer, but why do you think it did so well?
I think it's the combination of having a really spirited heroine who is living in a theatre in one of the most, that's the theatre, obviously, Drury Lane, but it's also at one of the most exciting times in European history. So the backdrop is the French Revolution. And I think that's that combination where there are really big questions being asked in society about freedom and rights. Along with the sort of lovely glitter of the, the theatrical background with some fantastic real-life characters, which I borrowed from history. I think that combination makes it a really exciting read.
And you have to do a lot of research for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that particular book came out of 5 years of studying for my doctorate at Oxford. I've got a very boring thesis sitting in the Bodleian Library all about that period. And this was the kind of stuff I never got to use. And the irony, of course, is that whereas about, I don't know, six brave scholars will read my thesis, you know, hundreds and thousands of people have read The Diamond of Drury Lane. So it just goes to show you never know what's going to happen when you start on a particular course of action.
Yes, I bet at the time you didn't think you'd become a children's author, did you?
Oh, no. I thought I was going to become some kind of serious academic somewhere, you know, in a cardigan, not quite smoking a pipe, but you know what I mean.
And is it nice being able to write for children? Does it give you quite a lot of freedom?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, initially when I first started writing, it was very much for my own children. So there was that lovely sort of gift relationship you have where you're able to write something and give it to your own kids. But it's expanded beyond that now. I have a whole sense of a readership out there thanks to social media, which, you know, is a mixed blessing. But the good side of it is that I really get to hear directly from readers. And when you write for kids, you get those fantastic emails or messages saying, you know, it was your book that really encouraged me to be a reader, or you really helped me through a difficult time in my life. That's often something you'll hear from young adults. And that's such a position of trust. And really, it's amazing that I get to be in that role.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to The Curious Crime, tell us about some of the characters, can you?
Yeah, okay. So thinking about the backdrop of the book, I don't know what your relationship at science was when you were at school. For me, it was a bit rocky. It was like the Brussels sprouts. You know, I knew that science lessons were good for me, but I can't say I sort of enjoyed them.
Yes.
So I went on from, you know, scroll forward quite a few years. In the last couple of years, I've been looking into the history of science for the non-fiction series of books for kids about the history of science you mentioned at the beginning. And I had this sort of revelation, really. I thought, well, you know, science is full of stories. I didn't realize it when I was at school, but looking at it as a historical subject, you can see the most amazing individuals, very, very brave men and women who have been scientists over the centuries. But also the questions that science are asking are ones I'm interested in. They're things right down to the heart of the matter, like who are we? What are the laws of the universe? Those kinds of big questions. And I was thinking, how can I put this newfound excitement, which I'm sure lots of people already knew, but I'm late to the party, how can I put all that into a novel and convey this to a younger reader? So I very often start with characters. And I wanted two characters who weren't the obvious heroes for a science-based book. So I chose, in a kind of Victorian setting, a girl who is told she can't be educated, and a boy from Algeria who is battling against the prejudice against somebody from Africa coming into a European setting to become a scholar. And they meet in a fantastical museum. The idea behind this was, I'm not going to teach the history of science in a kind of series of lessons in this book. I want the reader to walk around inside it. So the actual physical building of the science museum is the history of science. So think about it as a cross between like an enormous Hogwarts, that kind of sense of limitless rooms and floors and towers, that kind of thing, with Sherlock's mind palace. You know, he organizes his information in different rooms. So that's how I've done it. So you go at the front of the museum is where science has reached in about the late 19th century. And the further back you go, the older the scientific theories become. So you've got sort of abandoned ones like phlogiston. If you don't know what that is, it's kind of what they thought caused things to burn. And mesmerism, which was hugely popular in the 18th century. And then you go right back, you've got Aristotle's universe, where the Earth is at the center and the sun goes round us, all that stuff. So you kind of pick up the history of science just by trying to solve this murder mystery in the company of these two young characters. Oh, and they also have, because I love menageries and the idea of a scientific museum having a menagerie, they also have with them some creatures who are now extinct. My favorite, of course, is the dodo, who's called Philoponus, And there's also a Tasmanian wolf. That's a creature that only went extinct in the 20th century. But it's a kind of very bizarre marsupial. So it carries its baby in a pouch. And it looks a bit like a cross between a wolf and a hyena, something like that.
Yes.
It's a very, very strange creature. But I thought it'd be great to have this sort of these creatures we no longer have with us brought back to life for my Night in the Museum style book.
It's such a clever idea. The fact that, I mean, the best thing about doing something like this, I suppose, is that children can be learning without realizing they're learning, because it's all, you know, in a good story.
Oh, absolutely. You shouldn't feel at all that I'm sitting you down to teach you anything.
No.
It comes by the by, because it's part of the plot. And some of the plot hangs on the whole idea of what we put in museums. I don't know about you, but I've been blessed to go to many of the fantastic museums across Europe. So if you think of a place that brings the best of the Natural History Museum in London with the Museum Ireland in Berlin and the Vatican Museum in Rome, you know, all these wonderful museums we have in Europe, but you've kind of put them all together and turned them into a place which has no limits. You will never know it all, which is what I feel about my relationship with science. I'll never know it all.
Yeah.
So it becomes magical, doesn't it, without there being wizards or, you know, fairies. It's magical because there is so much to learn.
Yeah.
And I think I'm hoping really to inspire young readers to think, wow, you know, there is something in science for me. Even if I'm not best at chemistry, I can still enjoy the stories that chemistry is telling me, and biology and physics and all the other, and maths. I got to appreciate how important maths was through looking at the history of science, which I must admit wasn't my favourite subject at school.
No, I bet a lot of children and adults can relate.
I'm hoping just to kind of, I suppose it's bridging that divide between the kind of fiction and art and artistic subject and science, because I think very often the way obviously things are taught, you are in little groups where you do your fiction in your English lesson or your whatever language your, is your first language, and you do your science in your science lesson, and never the twain shall meet.
Mm.
So I'm crossing over that particular barrier.
Yeah, that's good. So how does this, the Curious Crime book, differ from your Curious Science series?
Oh, well, Curious Science, it's a Curious Science quest. That is absolutely much more information-bearing. It's a non-fiction series. So in that, I decided that I needed a guide to take me through the history of science. So the story is told from the point of view of two animal characters. One is Harriet, who is Darwin's tortoise. So there was really a Harriet who was brought back from the Galapagos. And she pals up with Schrodinger's cat. Now, you probably heard of the famous thought experiment as the cat in the box.
Yeah.
But when Schrodinger lived in Oxford, which is where I'm based, he actually did have a cat, a real pussy, and he called it Milton. So I thought, let's bring Milton on board, because, of course, the box with its, in the thought experiment, is a place of uncertainty. So I decided that this box is actually a time machine, and they go back in time right to the start. We begin right back in the caves, where we're looking at where did human curiosity come from? When did we start asking questions? And that's a lot about evolution and how human brains are different or the same to our closest ape. Well, we're not ancestors, but, you know, our closest cousins, I suppose. And then we go to look at the Greeks, which is sort of the beginning of a more formal idea of science. And then, as you mentioned, to the very rocky road that takes us from the Greeks to Galileo, which includes the Islamic Golden Age, which I'm ashamed to admit I knew nothing about. I had a vague idea that we'd got our numbering system from Islamic era, but I had no idea about the rest of the contributions that that period in history made. It sort of bridged the gap, that bit we used to call the Dark Ages. It bridged that gap between the Greeks and the sort of return of learning to Western Europe.
Right.
And then off we go to Newton, which, of course, is the experimental science heyday. And there are two more books to come to polish us off, and that's The Victorians, which is the 19th century, and then the 20th century up to, well, 2018. And that was fun. I've just been writing that one and trying to describe the quantum world to someone of around 10. It's been really fun, but also a huge challenge. And I've just learned so much whilst writing these books. And it just goes to show that it's never too late to learn.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, like you say, you could never really understand everything there is to know about science. The same with history as well.
Yeah, I should say that as well as my fictional guides in the Curious Science Quest, I also am kept on track by having a professor of nanomaterials at Oxford University and called Andrew Briggs as part of my writing team, and Roger Wagner, who is a sort of philosopher as well as a poet and an artist too, and they both are deeply, deeply knowledgeable about these subjects in a way that I didn't have time to be. So we've done it as a kind of joint enterprise, which has been really fun.
Mm.
I'm not used to writing with other people in the mix. I'm used to having my own world, but we've learned how to work with each other.
Oh, great. You made it work. And you also had some feedback and help from Professor Stephen Hawking.
Oh, yes. I thought that was like the absolute high point of my career. When I got that feedback, I thought, right, that's it. Nothing more can happen now. So how that happened is I was, because we're using the concept of time travel, there are two ways you can time travel, theoretically, in physics. One is to go very, very fast, and that means that time is relatively slower for you than people who are going slower. So if you're a space, an astronaut, and you go close to the speed of light, when you land again, everyone else has aged faster than you.
Yes.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? And the other one is to get really close to a black hole, because the crushing gravity aspect there bends space-time. So it's possible that you could time travel there. There are obviously problems about getting too close to a black hole. But anyway, the theory is that it could happen. So I'd written this, and then Andrew Briggs, Professor Briggs, showed it to Stephen Hawking when they had a meeting together. And I've got this little page of feedback from Stephen Hawking. I'm just so impressed and shocked that he had time to do this, telling me that there was another thing to bear in mind, which is theoretically you can't travel back in time beyond the age of the materials of which your time machine is built.
Ah, clever.
Presumably it would just kind of disappear around you or something.
Right.
So it's full of paradoxes. Anyway, so that was a real honour, and he's much missed.
Yes, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Curious Crime, it is out now, as well as Rocky Road to Galileo and Hunt with Newton. They're all by Julia Golding, who we've been chatting to. Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Debbie Howells to talk about her third novel, The Death of Her. She's also had The Beauty of the End and the Richard and Judy book club title, The Bones of You. Her latest book is described as a haunting psychological thriller. Welcome to the book show, Debbie.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Thanks very much for joining us. So how has this been, writing the third book compared to the first two? Is it getting any easier, or does that not really happen?
I think there are always challenges, always. I was talking to somebody the other day and saying that, you know, I have this self-inflicted pressure to try to write better, always. So, I am probably my own worst critic. But with this book, I did have a really, really clear idea of setting, and it's set in North Cornwall, and it's part of the world I know quite well, and so that really helped, because I could strongly visualise where it was taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the theme, is it a similar style to your other books?
The main character has lost her memory after a brutal attack. it's all my books are standalone. This particular book, I sort of delve into human memory, really, and our ability to convince ourselves that things are true, even when perhaps they're not. There's some very interesting studies that have been done about false memories being implanted and how we do tend to embellish them to the point where we end up believing things. So I have two characters in this book, and hopefully it's quite difficult to tell who is telling the truth.
So tell us about the two characters.
Well, the first is Evie, who is found battered and left for dead in a maize field. And the cover of the book is actually a really lovely cover that suits the story so well. It's a woman's figure running through maize at its highest height when, you know, it would be so easy to get lost. Mm. It's so tall. And anyway, her body is discovered, and she's airlifted and taken to hospital. And when she comes round, she remembers her name. And then a little while later, she remembers the name of her three-year-old daughter. But as the police investigation begins, there is no proof anywhere that her daughter ever existed.
Wow.
So there is a question of, you know, how damaged is she? Is that memory real, or is there something else that happened in her past that the police believe that perhaps she's, you know, in her traumatized state, she's remembering an event that happened a long time ago. Mm. And meanwhile, when they put out her details asking if anybody recognizes her, a woman comes forward who knew her from that time, a long time ago, at the time of this other event. And so their stories are kind of tangled from then, and also they now. And they're both quite complicated characters, but between them the truth comes out.
And where did you get the whole idea from for this story, do you know?
I think it was actually, initially, it was extraordinary, actually. I was walking through a maize field, and there was this sense of how you could just walk, you could easily lose your sense of direction. And then at the heart of this particular field, I found an electric fenced off rectangular area, not very big, and I thought how strange that was.
Mm.
Why had this small area in the middle of this field been fenced off? And unless you, I mean, presumably now with drones and what have you, anybody can see, it's have an aerial view of what is going on below. But actually, you know, you could quite easily be lost. Things could be hidden amongst this crop because of its height. And that's kind of set off this whole chain of events. But that alongside, you know, memory. Memory is an interesting one. Because we don't remember things accurately. I mean, the best will in the world, we can be convinced something happened the way it did happen. And sometimes we're wrong. We don't know it.
It's weird, isn't it, if you have two people who remember things completely differently and you can both be convinced that you're right.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And that's what's going on in this story. You have two versions of what is going on. Yes, this study that I read about was quite extraordinary, really. It's we are very suggestible, I think.
Mm.
And particularly if you take the case of a vulnerable woman who's been attacked and is so short of fat, desperate to try and find out what's actually happened and kind of reaffirm her place in her life. She's clutching at whatever comes her way, but it isn't always accurate.
No. And I always think when you read books or watch films or TV programs about people, particularly women, I guess, in vulnerable situations like this, and then you see the lawyers who, you know, don't care and are trying to do anything just to win their case and kind of making them think that they're a bit crazy, and it can be really upsetting and distressing, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yes, when somebody is really vulnerable, they do. They need help more than ever. The proper help, don't they?
Mm.
It's so easy for them to be exploited.
Yeah, absolutely. So, did you have to do a lot of research for this book?
Yeah, I did. I was try to read around the subjects I write about. And it's usually things in real life that kind of, a lot of ideas tend to converge when I start writing a book. It's a funny process in that I can think I have something, but it generally I kind of put on threads that come from different directions, and then actually I feel like I have something solid I can start writing with.
Mm.
But yes, I did read a lot about memory, and just as, I mean, when I wrote The Bones of You, which was my first book, the subject of that is emotional abuse. And again, you know, there is actually, research is relatively easy now because of the internet. And, you know, there are just, you know, real life accounts of what goes on.
Yeah.
And the same with memory, you know.
And it's important to make sure what you're talking about is realistic, you know, so people don't read and think, oh, yeah, as if that would happen.
Absolutely. And also, I always have in my mind that if there's somebody reading who's been affected by the subject that I'm writing about,
yeah,
I really want it to be relatable. I don't want it to be kind of glossed over or minimised. It's so important that it does ring true.
Yeah, for sure. And are you quite disciplined with your writing? Do you treat it as a job? Do you spend a certain amount a day doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is my job. I work Monday to Friday, always, pretty much always. And when I'm really in the swing of it, I will work probably kind of dawn till into the evening. And maybe weekends, if there's a deadline. But it's flexible. This is the wonderful thing. So I can work all out, and then I can take some time off.
Mm. So you do allow yourself some time off?
Oh, yes.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Death of Her, it's available to buy on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section, and it's by Debbie Howells, who we've been chatting to. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Craig Taylor, who lives in Oxford, teaching at the Oxford International Centre for Publishing Studies, where he's an associate lecturer. He's also a freelance editor of fiction, and under the pen name C.M. Taylor, he's an author of Premiership Psycho and Group of Death. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest novel, a comic and touching geriatric coming-of-age story about the impact of Brexit on British expats in Spain. It's called Staying On. Welcome to the Book Show, Craig.
Thank you very much for having me, Hannah.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what a great subject to tackle, seeing that we are British expats living in Spain.
Indeed. Yeah, well, so were my parents. My parents moved out to the Costa Blanca in the late 50s and got a little villa with a pool, and we're up in the hills. And I visited them on many an occasion, and loved the place very much. I was very inspired by the physical beauty and the way of life, and went as often as I could. And then obviously in 2008, when things went wrong with the banks, the sort of expat way of life became a bit more difficult with inflation and pension erosion. And I remember there were lots of people talking about leaving, lots of their friends. They were part of a sort of expat gang who lived on an urbanization. And then that settled down a little bit, and people were no longer talking so much about going home to England. And then Brexit came along and sort of revived all that again. And just made me imagine a couple. I wanted to write about a mature marriage and a couple, and basically one of them wants to go home to England, being disturbed by Brexit, and the other one wants to stay in Spain and forget about some difficult issues in the past.
Mm.
So that's the sort of inspiration and the setup of the book.
Yes, and it's set in the Costa Blanca, isn't it?
Yeah, it's set in the Val de Pop, or the Halon Valley, depending on which language you use, whether you use Valenciana or Spanish. Yeah, it's set in the village of Parcent, but it's not named as such.
And how would you describe that area for people who haven't been there?
Oh, sure. It's about 15 miles in from the coast. It's in an agricultural valley. It's quite mountainous. Lots of cherry trees higher up, but lower down in the valley, there's a lot of olives and a huge amount of oranges. And very, very beautiful. Quite sparsely populated. And just kind of paradise. I miss it very much. My parents are back in England now.
Mm. And when did they go back and why?
Oh, they came back about 5 years ago, and just the usual thing, you know, where is home? Where do we want to live? You know, they were getting on a bit, and just had that conversation between themselves about where they wanted to spend the last few years of their lives. You know, some of their friends had grown old and frail out in Spain, and I think that question was very much on their minds.
Mm, yeah, interesting. It's a difficult thing. I mean, a lot of our listeners will have faced the same issues and questions, not just whether to stay in Spain or to go back to their native country, but also the issue of Brexit, obviously, and how that is going to affect people living in Spain. Because the reality is, we don't really know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's psychologically very disturbing, and I think that if a couple or if a family is having a debate about what to do, whether to come or whether to go, then that Brexit highlights those issues and pushes them up to the fore. And I know that a lot of people are troubled by the ongoing anxiety of the situation, and they kind of feel in limbo. And I wanted to write a story that dealt with the sort of day-to-day realities of normal people rather than was kind of up in the dealing with the political slogans and the hard politics of it. I wanted to kind of drop down and deal with the terrain of everyday lives, really. The book isn't overtly political all the way through in that it's not sort of obsessed with Brexit. Brexit is the thing which gets this idea of should we stay or should we go going. It's the kind of motivator. It brings the story to the boil, but the action is very much on the human level. You know, it's played out between a couple, and ultimately it's resolved when the daughter-in-law. In a way, the book is a buddy movie between the older husband, a guy called Tony, who's the main character of the book, and he has a very unusual friendship with with his daughter-in-law. He's very close to her, and she kind of comes to the Costa Blanca for a long visit, and she is able to understand what he's going through and just kind of silently guides him along and helps him to deal with his wife, who is dead set on staying and doesn't want to talk about it, thank you very much. So that's what he has to deal with. But I also deal with the theme of class, which I think is very important in this, in dealing with Spain. I mean, I think a lot of people in England are a bit snooty about Spain when they think about places like Benidorm or the Costa Brava or the Costa Blanca, and they just, you know, they think Italy's all pasta and high quality and let's all mince around in Tuscany, whereas when they think about Spain, they're just a bit snobby about it. And that makes me upset and cross, and as someone who's been to Benidorm and loved Benidorm and seen all these elegant elder couples dancing, you know, as they do, it's not all kind of hedonism and young people drinking. It's very beautiful to watch older people dressed up kind of doing tea dancing in the afternoon. It's a very lovely thing. And so I wanted to address this kind of snobbery that people have about retiring to Spain, the idea that it's a kind of working class thing and it's all like, you know, chips and John Smith's beer and Yorkshire pudding. And, you know, there is a bit of that, but so what? There's also, you know, lots of other things going on. So class is a big aspect of the book as well. I wanted these people to speak and to represent themselves. You know, I know the expats in Spain very well, having spent, I don't know, I suppose over a year in the valley in total, and I know these people, and I just had never seen them represented.
No, I'm glad you've gone along that route, because it's true. I mean, people in the UK might have that opinion because of what they've seen or read in the British media, you know, the types of programmes that are made about certain areas of Spain, or the articles, the news stories that are shared are always the ones that kind of shock people or make people think, oh God, I can't believe people live like that, you know, the stories that you get in, unfortunately, places like Benidorm, and it is a real shame, because, as you say, there are so many areas of Spain that are absolutely stunning, with people that aren't walking around with their tops off drinking John Smith.
Yeah, it's absolutely the case, and yeah, it does seem to be a class thing. The middle classes are allowed to go and, you know, wander around Italy, and that's somehow seen as better than going to Spain. And, you know, as someone who's lived in Spain and loved the place, it made me cross that this view prevailed, and I sort of wanted to do something about it, to represent these people. You know, and I had opposition in within English publishing when I was talking about this book, trying to get it out there in the first place. I was told that people don't want to read about working class people, that working class people aren't aspirational, that the characters I was writing about were not interesting, and people only wanted to read about middle class people. Obviously, the people who told me this had sort of posh names and expensive educations, and they were coming from a certain view of life, and I found that quite upsetting as well, this idea that working class people, if they appear in literature, have to appear as stereotypes, you know, victims, criminals, chimney sweeps, mechanics, and, you know, why couldn't you write about an ordinary working class family that had a rich inner life, even if they weren't necessarily the most eloquent people in the world? That didn't necessarily mean that they didn't have complicated and difficult feelings like everybody else.
Of course.
So that was part of the motivation.
It's interesting, because the majority of British people who I know living in Spain like to experience Spanish culture. You know, they love going out to Spanish restaurants. You know, they're not obsessed with kind of, you know, your fish and chips and Yorkshire puddings and things like that. A lot of people have quite a balanced life here. You know, some people in the winter time, for example, enjoy going and having a Sunday roast sometimes, but the rest of the time they're enjoying eating, going out for tapas and you know, really embracing Spanish culture.
Sure. And, you know, and also, why shouldn't expats in another country enjoy the culture that they bring with them? I live in Oxford. There's a big Portuguese community down the road. Now, I'm enormously happy that they continue in their Portuguese ways, because it means I get great coffee and good custard tarts. And there's a little Portuguese cafe there. And, you know, and I would be upset if the Portuguese community in Oxford didn't feel able to carry on being Portuguese. It doesn't mean that they're not assimilating to England as well.
That's a very good point.
So, yeah, identity is very complicated. You know, you come from a road, you come from a city, you come from a region, you come from a county, you come from a country. You know, I personally grew up in Yorkshire, but I have affiliations to Oxford. I have affiliations to Spain. I feel European. You know, I think you can have a splendid and various identity, and I don't think you can be pinned down. So, yeah, I don't mind seeing people having the odd Yorkshire pud in Spain. It doesn't offend me.
Yeah, and obviously each to their own, and this is just my personal opinion, but I think it makes people more interesting if they're able to kind of relate to different places and different cultures. You know, if people just say, oh, I'm British and I'm a Londoner and that's it, then they're obviously happy with that, and that's fine. But I love being able to say, oh, I grew up in London and then had my teenage years in Dorset and travelled around the world and now live in Spain. And I can identify with quite a few different areas and cultures. And I love that. I think that's really interesting when you meet people. And that's quite common as an expat to meet other people who are in the same kind of place, identifying with lots of places. And that makes us interesting, surely.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that the minute you stop and declare, this is me, I'm finished, this is my identity, then you stop growing in a way.
Mm.
You said, you know, I'm finished, and this is the end, and this is who I am. Whereas I think identity is something that you develop and which changes and which you work on and evolves as you grow emotionally and as you know, change places physically as well. So I think the minute you declare your identity is chiseled in stone, I think emotionally that's probably quite a perilous thing to do, really, because you stop being able to respond and you become quite vociferous about your identity at that point.
Yeah, I agree. Well, if people want to read more, they can get a copy of Staying On. It's by Craig Taylor, or C.M. Taylor, as we've been chatting to today. Craig, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Absolute pleasure.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Grace Mead, one of America's leading trial attorneys turned authors and its first transgendered trial attorney. She faced much confliction over her identity and for decades struggled with dysphoria and depression. Defense of Another is a work 11 years in the making and her debut novel. Drawing from her own personal experience, it's an emotionally charged exploration of what it means to be gay in modern America. Welcome to the book show, Grace.
Good morning, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us. So tell us about your journey. It sounds like a big journey that you've been on to write this book.
Well, I started it in 2007, and really it was a way of wrestling with whether there was any merit whatsoever with the notion there was anything wrong with being queer. And it took a long time, but eventually I could find zero basis for any sort of moral opprobrium.
And how did the book develop from that?
Well, for example, the one dream sequence in the book is a dream that I had. It is one of the more direct examples, and it is a nightmare of having leprosy. So obviously deeply connected to the religious condemnation some have for being queer.
Mm-hmm.
There are characters in the book through which I explored being openly gay, characters in the book from which I explored cisgender and straight people's viewpoints about queer people. And I did not write about a trans person because 2007 was some 8 years before marriage equality in the United States, and I couldn't fathom acceptance for a trans person at that time.
Mm. Isn't that sad? But how amazing how we've come on a lot since then, do you think?
I am astonished. I was a pessimist about marriage equality when it happened, really only about 5-6 months after I disclosed on a large scale and began presenting authentically, and Caitlyn Jenner was disclosing at the same time I was disclosing on a much smaller scale to so many colleagues and fellow lawyers.
And how was it taken at work?
It was taken unbelievably well. Everyone deserves enormous credit. And of course, the vast majority of those to whom I disclosed were straight, cisgendered, and to hold something completely secret from the rest of the world for some 25, 26 years, to not tell a soul, creates a sort of fear that's difficult to describe, and a fear even in someone like me who had incredible advantages in this world and still does. And to have them react so positively was just jaw-dropping.
Oh, I bet. I think it's very difficult for people to imagine what something like that must be like, keeping a secret from the rest of the world for some 25 years. People, unless they've been in a similar situation, people can't really understand that, can they?
Well, I hope I've communicated it in part, both through the essays on the website and through the book.
Mm. So was this a cathartic experience for you, would you say, writing the book?
Well, you know, the first couple of years were quite painful, actually, because I was reaching conclusions that took me places that I was ambivalent about going. I clung to my profession, for example, very much to make it day by day. And then post-transition to rewrite it was a very different experience, and I found joy in reworking the prose and joy in individual scenes and chapters and the dialogue. So it ranged the gamut from being a painful process to being a joyous one.
Mm. So do you think now, I know you said in 2007 when you started writing the book you didn't feel that you could write it about a transgender person. Do you think you could now?
Well, this particular plot wouldn't necessarily work for a transgendered person, and I can't reveal why without spoilers. But I absolutely think I could.
That's great. Fantastic. So could that be your next project, do you think?
Well, I want to see reader reaction to this one, because a sequel is certainly possible and would contain much the cast of characters.
Okay.
But, you know, a novel about being trans is possible, too. I wrote about 10,000 words of essays on the website, and it's far short of a full-blown memoir, but I've always admired most memoirs written far later in life, when people have more perspective, and I felt 10,000 words was about what I could write right now with the right perspective, and that perspective would change significantly in a few years.
And for people who, because I'm sure there's still people out there who maybe don't understand fully what it means to be transgender, can you explain?
Well, you know, since memory, I wanted to be a girl and then a woman. And it both occurs so naturally and is something that seems so impossible that that is a war that is going on constantly. My thoughts as a child would range from maybe everyone else thinks this too, and they just never say anything, to maybe I'm schizophrenic. But my only exposure to schizophrenia was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I certainly didn't want a lobotomy.
No, quite. And I know you said you weren't able to tell anybody this for 25 years. Did you ever meet anybody or was aware of anybody else going through the same thing?
Well, aside from sort of the Jerry Springer show, the first exposure I had to anyone who was trans, and it obviously wasn't a personal meeting, when I graduated from college, I went and saw Rent on Broadway. And the character Angel there is trans, and actually, in many ways, a very affirming character, if impoverished, and if living a life very, very different than mine, facing many of the disadvantages that too many trans people face. But she's a wonderful person in the play, and it really stuck with me.
Yeah, it's so important to have people like that represented on television, in film, in theatre, things like that. It must make a difference to a lot of people.
Oh, absolutely. Janet Mock is someone who was very important to me, simply reading her book and now her work with Pose, but really, truly an incredibly impressive woman.
Yeah. So let's talk about the characters in Defense of Another. The main character is Matt, yeah? What do you know about him?
So he is a young, closeted gay lawyer in New Orleans who's attacked in an alley one night and kills one of his attackers. And after chapter one, it gets interesting.
And you can't tell us more than that.
No, I mean, I certainly can. Matt, in many ways, bears a strong resemblance to version 1.0 of myself. I think that anyone who knows me will see many similarities, though I think many people who worked with me, I was effective at wearing a mask there. In the essays, I talk about taking a social psychology class or abnormal psychology class, perhaps, and the professor saying, the problem for depressed people is people don't generally want to spend time around other people who are unhappy, which, of course, worsens their social isolation. Well, that was not my experience after, say, elementary school, but that was because I learned to develop a mask, to muster up the strength in social and professional situations so that they were relatively positive.
Mm, absolutely. So do you think a lot of people could relate to Matt, the character?
I certainly hope so. You know, the goal is to identify our common identity as human beings. One advantage, I think, of living this life where you essentially know no one else like you in one way until you're 25 or 26 is you have to learn to identify with other people as human beings.
Mm.
And that's a real challenge, right? If our obligation is to treat anyone human with dignity, that's a huge project for us as a society, but it's an enormously worthwhile one.
Mm. And do you think, looking back, do you wish you could have revealed that you were transgender many years beforehand, or do you think it happened the right time for you?
Well, it's probably odd a bit coming from me, but I generally don't do large counterfactuals. And I did not have the strength required to do it sooner.
Mm.
And I wish perhaps I had, but none of us can change history, including our own. And I'm just very grateful to be as happy as I am today, to have, in the last 4 years, realized two childhood dreams, presenting authentically and writing a novel, the first of which I thought was impossible. The second I knew would be quite difficult.
Oh, congratulations to you, Grace.
Thank
then.
You.
That's amazing. If people want to get a copy of Defense of Another, it's out now. It's by Grace Mead, who we've been chatting to. People can buy it on our website in the TRE bookshop section. Grace Mead, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Talk Radio Europe.